Your next patient in your dermatology practice is Mr. Stevens, a 47-year-old man who is concerned about a recurrent cyst on his upper back. He states he tried squeezing it all out about 6 months ago, but it came right back. He saw another physician 2 months ago who incised and drained the cyst, and now Mr. Stevens is concerned that it keeps coming back and is so big it can be seen through his shirt. On your physical exam, you note a firm, mildly tender, smooth ovoid nodule within the skin on his back. It is not fluctuant. Mr. Stevens asks, "Can you take it off for me so this doesn't keep happening?" And as you examine Mr. Stevens, you wonder, what could be the cause of this finding, and why does it keep coming back? And what are the management strategies for Mr. Stevens? Consider your answers as we begin this next episode. Welcome to Audio Bricks. I'm Adam Weinstein, bringing histology from our bricks to your ears. After completing this section, you will be able to 1. Discuss the two major ways epithelium is organized. 2. Describe the structural components of and histologic features of epithelial tissue. 3. Explain how covering or lining types of epithelium are classified. 4. Describe the unique and characteristic features of glandular epithelium. And 5. Describe the 5 types of epithelial intercellular junctions. Part 1. What is epithelial tissue and how is it organized? Epithelial tissue provides our body's protection from hazards in the outside world, shielding our bodies from ultraviolet radiation, ingested toxins, and inhaled smoke. It also absorbs nutrients, transports electrolytes, secretes hormones, and regulates body temperature by producing sweat. Epithelium is one of the 4 basic tissue types, along with muscle tissue, nerve tissue, and connective tissue. It is found throughout the body, covering it, lining organs, vessels, and cavities, and forming glands. We'll begin this episode with some general principles of how epithelial tissue is organized before we discuss its various component structures. Epithelial tissue can be organized into layers that line or cover surfaces like the skin, blood vessels, or gastrointestinal tract. We'll call this type of epithelial tissue lining epithelia. Or it can be organized into glands that specialize in secreting different products either into the body or the external environment. We'll call this type of epithelial tissue glandular epithelia. Sometimes the specific role of an epithelial tissue gives it a unique name, like urothelium, which is the epithelium that lines the lower urinary tract, or endothelium, the epithelium that lines the blood vessels. Epithelial tissue has aggregates of epithelial cells that are tightly connected to each other by different types of intercellular junctions. Epithelial cells rest on a supportive structure called the basement membrane. This separates them from underlying tissue like muscle, connective tissue, and blood vessels, but still allows passage of nutrients, signaling molecules, and other proteins. Because of this separation, the epithelial cells do not have blood vessels right next to them supplying them with oxygen and nutrients. Instead, oxygen and nutrients must passively diffuse across the basement membrane to supply these cells. Okay, let's take a quick break for a question. What are the 2 main ways epithelial tissue may be organized? Epithelial tissue may be organized into layers or glands. Part 2. What makes up the different structures of epithelial tissue? The first structure of epithelial tissue we'll talk about is none other than the epithelial cells. Epithelial cells are notable in that they have polarity or sidedness. This means that unlike many other cells, different sides of the epithelial cell have different functions and different protein expression. For example, membrane receptors or channels may differ on one side compared to the other, allowing differential function between one side of the cell and the opposite side. The 2 sides are called the apical membrane, which is the side that is furthest and facing away from the basement membrane, and the basolateral membrane, which is the side, actually typically the 3 other sides, resting against the basement membrane. In situations where we need to distinguish the 2 sides of the cell connecting the apical and basolateral membranes, we would refer to them as the lateral membranes. Epithelial cell polarity is exemplified well by renal tubular epithelial cells. These cells have a special function responsible for transporting ions and molecules from one side of the cell to the other. For example, renal tubular epithelial cells are well known for needing to reabsorb sodium from the tubular lumen back into the blood. In this example, sodium and water moves from the tubular lumen across the apical cell membrane. This may be through specialized protein transporters on the apical membrane designed to reabsorb sodium and/or water. Once in the cell, the sodium diffuses freely to the basolateral membrane, which has a different protein transporter that allows sodium to exit the cell and freely diffuses across the basement membrane and into the interstitium, where it once again freely diffuses its way to a capillary vessel. As I noted earlier, epithelial cells rest on a structure called the basement membrane. The basement membrane provides support and also separates the epithelial cells from the underlying tissue, including the blood vessels. You can think of it as the bottommost layer or floor of the epithelial tissue. The basement membrane is typically composed of two layers, called the basal lamina and the reticular lamina. The first layer, or the basal lamina layer, has two zones. The first zone is called the lamina lucida and is located right next to the epithelial cell's basolateral membrane. It contains specialized glycoproteins called laminins, which bind to bridging structures called hemidesmosomes. Hemidesmosomes link the basal lamina to the adjacent epithelial cell. Laminin proteins have a number of other functions in maintaining the structural architecture, for example, guiding embryologic development, wound healing, and serving as a barrier for invading cancer cells. The second zone is called the lamina densa. It lies just underneath the lamina lucida. It contains type 4 collagen, plus various glycoproteins and proteoglycans as structural supports. The second layer of the basement membrane, the reticular lamina, is on the other side of the basal lamina. It is also composed of connective tissue, providing additional structural support to the epithelial cells. Let's review what we've just covered with a quick question. Can you name the two layers of the basement membrane? The basement membrane is made up of the basal lamina layer and the reticular lamina. Remember, the basal lamina has two zones, the lamina lucida and the lamina densa. Part 3. How do we classify lining epithelium? Now that we've discussed the basic structure and components of epithelial tissue, let's talk more about lining epithelia. Lining epithelia are classified based on two specific features, the shape of the cells on the outermost surface and the number of layers of cells. Regarding cell shape, cells that are flat are classified as and called squamous epithelia. Cells that are cube-shaped are called cuboidal epithelia. And lastly, cells that are more column-shaped are helpfully called columnar epithelia. Regarding number of layers, epithelia that have one layer are called simple epithelia, and those that have more than one layer are called stratified epithelia. Although things can't be that easy, right? One tricky example is when the epithelia are actually one layer, but may have a false appearance of having more than one layer. Epithelia with this structural appearance are called pseudostratified epithelia. Pseudostratified epithelial cells are a single layer of cells that all rest on the basal lamina. However, under the microscope, because the nuclei do not line up linearly like they do for simple epithelia, they falsely appear to be made up of multiple layers. There is also a special type of stratified epithelium that is called transitional epithelium. Transitional epithelium are often seen in tissues that need to stretch, like the urothelium of the bladder and ureters. Cells in the lowest layer of transitional epithelia are cuboidal or columnar, whereas cells in the upper or more outer layers may have a more varied appearance. If you were to look at urothelium, the cells may look cuboidal when the bladder is empty and not needing to stretch, but then they may appear more flattened or squamous when the bladder is full and the cells benefit from being able to stretch. Okay, let's test our knowledge of these classifications with a question. What are the terms for the three different types of shapes of epithelial cells? Epithelial cells can be squamous, cuboidal, or columnar. Part 4. Descriptive examples of lining epithelial cells. Now that we have described the different types of shapes and layers of epithelial cells, let's consider examples of each type. An example of simple squamous epithelium are the epithelial cells that line blood vessels, called endothelium. Because squamous cells are so flat, when looking under the microscope, it may be hard to distinguish cellular structures and their exact borders. But the layer can be identified by the linear appearance of flattened dark staining nuclei. Renal tubular epithelial cells are an example of a simple cuboidal epithelium. Compared to flat squamous cells, the cells are cube or square-shaped, and in the case of the renal tubules, arranged in a circle, with the basement membrane surrounding the outside of each circular cluster. An example of simple columnar epithelium occurs in the cells of the GI tract. The cells are elongated like columns. In simple columnar epithelia, the nuclei line up in a rather uniform line near the basolateral membrane of the elongated cells. In contrast, with pseudostratified columnar epithelium, like from the respiratory tract, the nuclei do not line up nicely, making it seem as if there are multiple layers when there's actually only one layer of cells. Many tissues have transitions in which two different types of epithelia exist side by side. For example, this occurs at the junction where the rectum, which is made up of a single layer of column-shaped cells, a simple columnar epithelium, transitions to the anus, which is made up of multiple layers of flat cells, a stratified squamous epithelium. The rectum is still part of the absorptive intestine, so the columnar epithelia are important in transporting water, whereas the anus is an extension of the skin, so it is lined with tough, stratified squamous epithelia to be more resistant to trauma. Let's wrap this up with a review question. What are the terms for the number of layers of epithelial cells? Epithelial cells can be simple epithelium, which is consisting of one layer, stratified epithelium, which is consisting of more than one layer, or pseudostratified epithelium, which is technically consisting of one layer, but appearing as more than one layer under the microscope. Part 5, examples of specialized structures in lining epithelial cells. Some epithelial cells have specialized surface structures that help to carry out their unique functions. These special surface structures, called microvilli, cilia, and stereocilia, are seen in epithelial cells that line structures like the airways, renal tubules, and the gut. Microscopically, they all appear as hair-like projections off the apical epithelial cell membrane. However, they differ from each other in size, spacing, and internal structure, and these differences give each of these structures their own unique function. First, let's discuss microvilli. Microvilli are tightly spaced, finger-like extensions of cells that help increase the cell's apical membrane surface area and increase an epithelial cell's capacity for absorption and secretion. They are found in places where absorption or secretion is of primary importance, such as the renal tubules and the lining of the GI tract. Microvilli contain a core of actin filaments that are cross-linked by a protein called villin. Epithelial cells with microvilli are sometimes said to have a brush border because the microvilli are so short and numerous they make the apical membrane of these cells appear like a brush. Okay. Time for a question break. What function do microvilli play for gastrointestinal epithelial cells? Microvilli increase the apical membrane surface area, increasing the absorptive surface of the cells and permitting more absorption of water, ions, and nutrients. Next, let's talk about cilia. Cilia are thin, highly motile extensions of the apical membranes on some epithelial cells. The word cilia comes from the Latin word for eyelash, so they are well named, as it is very much what they look like on light microscopy. Each cilium has a structure that consists of 9 pairs of peripheral microtubules surrounding 2 central microtubules. This 9+2 arrangement of microtubule pairs, or doublets, is called an axoneme. Dyneme arms are proteins on each microtubule doublet. They function as the molecular motor proteins of this structure, driving the beat of the cilia. Cilia are found on many epithelial cells and are particularly recalled in the respiratory tract and reproductive systems. In the respiratory tract, cilia line the pseudostratified columnar respiratory epithelia and help remove inhaled particulates from the airway environment. Cilia also line the columnar epithelium of the fallopian tube, helping guide the egg from the ovary towards the uterus. In men, they guide the sperm to the epididymis for maturation. An interesting clinical correlation to note, the immotile cilia syndrome, also known as Cartagener syndrome or primary ciliary dyskinesia, is an autosomal recessive genetic disorder where genes that encode for ciliary proteins are mutated, causing loss of ciliary function in the various tissues, including the respiratory tract, eustachian tube, and middle ear, fallopian tube, and flagellum of sperm cells. The cilia's axonemes do not have functioning dyneme, the motor protein, so their movement becomes ineffective. This syndrome is associated with sterility in men, reduced fertility in women, and recurrent lower respiratory tract infections, among other symptoms. Cilia are best known for their motion. However, there are important functions and clinical correlations for non-motile cilia. For example, renal tubular cells each have non-motile cilia, which aid in sensing the direction of the tubular flow and provide signaling to help renal tubular epithelial cells maintain their polarity or sightedness. Apical versus basolateral. When these non-motile cilia in the kidney lose their function, then cysts may form, such as occurs in polycystic kidney disease. And the last specialized structure of epithelial cells to be discussed are stereocilia. Despite their name, stereocilia are not really anything like cilia and are actually more similar to microvilli. They are uniquely long microvilli made up of actin filaments. They are found in only a few places in our bodies, including the male reproductive tract and sensory components of the inner ear. For example, in the inner ear, they assist with hearing and balance by sensing and beginning the process of converting physical force in the form of fluid motion from sound or head movement into an electrical signal that is sent to the brain. Part 6, all about glands and their secretions. So far, we've discussed epithelial cells that come in sheets, like the skin, or line various body tubes, like the GI tract or renal tubules. Epithelial cells can also form glands. Glands are defined as a collection of cells that release substances into the body or the external environment. Epithelial cells form many glands in the body, and these glands can be divided into endocrine and exocrine glands. Endocrine glands secrete their products, called hormones, into the interstitial space around the cells, from which nearby blood vessels take them up and circulate them throughout the bloodstream to get to their target organs. Endocrine glands include the thyroid gland, parathyroid glands, anterior pituitary, adrenal cortex, and islets of Langerhans in the pancreas. Exocrine glands secrete their products onto epithelial surfaces, such as onto the skin or into the GI tract. Note that their products are not hormones because they do not circulate. I wonder if our patient, Mr. Stevens' recurring cysts, might be a problem related to an exocrine gland. I recall he described being able to squeeze and drain it. In any case, exocrine glands include the mammary and sweat glands, plus the secretory glands of the stomach and pancreas that aid with digestion, but there are many others. I'm going to focus the rest of our discussion specifically on exocrine glands. Structurally, exocrine glands are formed from epithelial tissue that grows inwards into the connective tissue, forming secretory units. Exocrine glands have a number of different characteristics that can distinguish them. Let's consider three such differences: their structure, the type of product they secrete, and the mechanism by which they secrete their products. First, let's talk about how glands differ based on structure. Glands may be unicellular and composed of a single cell, or they may be multicellular, meaning they are composed of multiple cells. Unicellular glands secrete their products directly from a single cell using a process called exocytosis, in which the product's transport and release occurs directly from that cell's surface. A prime example of unicellular glands are goblet cells. They are called goblet cells due to their shape, which resembles a wine glass. Goblet cells are often found interspersed within the columnar cells lining the intestinal and respiratory tracts. Multicellular glands make their product in a multicellular secretory unit and then transport their secretion through a duct, releasing it onto the epithelial surface. This type includes most human exocrine glands, like sweat glands and mammary glands. The morphology of this secretory unit can be tubular, or it can be acinar or alveolar, which looks like they are forming small sacs, or a mix of the two types. In addition, the glands can either be simple, with unbranched ducts, like a sweat gland, or compound, with branching ducts, like mammary glands. Next, let's discuss how glands differ based on what type of product is being secreted. Glands may secrete serous products, mucus-like products, or a mixed seromucus product. Serous glands secrete a watery, proteinaceous substance that often contains enzymes. An example is the chief cells of the stomach that secrete digestive enzymes into the GI tract. Mucus glands secrete mucus, a viscous, slippery substance that contains mucin, a glycoprotein. It's great at lubricating a surface. An example of mucus glands are the esophageal glands, secreting mucus to help food get to the stomach. Mixed seromucus glands secrete both proteins and mucus. An example of this includes the salivary glands, because saliva contains both enzymes and mucus. Lastly, glands differ based on how the gland secretes its products. Glands may be eccrine, apocrine, or holocrine based on the mechanism by which their products are secreted. Eccrine glands, also called merocrine glands, release their contents via exocytosis. This process involves packaging the product into vesicles, which are then transported to the cell surface, where they fuse with the apical cell membrane, releasing the product into the duct. Salivary glands and eccrine sweat glands are examples of this type of gland. Apocrine glands secrete their product along with a portion of the apical cell membrane and cytoplasm. As the product reaches the apical cell membrane, a portion of the cell is pinched off and released into the duct. Examples include the mammary glands and the apocrine sweat glands in the armpit. Holocrine glands first accumulate their secretions intracellularly, and then the cell dies and becomes part of the secretion. The entire cell's contents are thus secreted. Sebaceous glands in the skin are examples of this type of gland. A common clinical correlate to our discussion of sebaceous glands is the skin condition called acne. Acne occurs in part because of over-secretion of sebum made in the sebaceous glands. This clogs the hair follicles, leading to the characteristic inflamed skin lesions, a mnemonic device that may assist in remembering the difference between apocrine and holocrine glands is the following. Associate holocrine with whole ocrine to remember that the whole cell becomes part of the secretion, and apocrine with the apical membrane to remember that a portion of the cell becomes part of the secretion. Let's now summarize a few of the more familiar epithelial exocrine glands along with their secreted product and basic function. First, there are the sweat glands. These are located in the skin and may be eccrine, most of the skin, or apocrine, in the axilla and perianal regions. Their secreted product is sweat, and it functions for body cooling and sexual attraction. Another type of gland are the sebaceous glands. These are also on the skin, and these produce sebum, which functions to keep the skin lubricated and helps with waterproofing of the skin. Mammary glands, as most of you already know, are located in the breasts, and they serve to produce milk, which is ideal for infant nutrition. The salivary glands are located in the mouth, and they produce saliva, which helps with digestion. The stomach has gastric glands, which produce pepsinogen, chymosin, and hydrochloric acid, whereas the liver has hepatocytes, and they produce bile. These all assist with digestion as well. The last example I'll mention is the exocrine pancreas, which produces lipase, amylase, and trypsinogen, all of which also help with digestion. All right, now let's test our knowledge again with a question break. What are the types of exocrine glands categorized by their mode or mechanism of secretion? The three types of exocrine glands are eccrine, apocrine, and holocrine. Part 7. How do epithelial cells connect together? Like I mentioned earlier, epithelial cells are tightly connected to each other, forming sheets and/or glands. They work together to serve complex functions like nutrient absorption, wound healing, and gland secretion. All of this requires cell-to-cell teamwork. And this teamwork is largely based on their connections with each other, which we will refer to as intercellular junctions. There are 5 main types of intercellular junctions, and unfortunately, they often have multiple names, which can be confusing. These junctions serve several purposes. First, they bind the epithelial cells together, allowing them to form characteristic sheets, tubes, or tubules. They also bind epithelial cells to the surrounding extracellular matrix, specifically to basement membranes. In addition to binding, they allow direct molecular communication from cell to cell, creating a true epithelial network responding as a unit, not just individual cells. And lastly, they regulate the passage of fluids and molecules in the space between the adjacent epithelial cells, a process critical in regions where transport is the main function, like the kidney and gut. Okay, let's discuss each of the 5 types of intercellular junctions in more detail. These will include the belt desmosomes, spot desmosomes, hemidesmosomes, gap junctions, and tight junctions. The binding of epithelial cells to each other allows formation of sheets and glands. This binding is done by junctions called desmosomes. There are 2 types of desmosomes, and these are the first 2 types of intercellular junctions I'm going to cover. They include belt desmosomes, also known as zonulae adherens or adherens junctions, and spot desmosomes, also known as maculae adherens. Note the word adherens for both of these. They stick the cells together. Belt desmosomes are well named. These wrap around the cells like a belt and connect epithelial cells together. They are helpful in resisting shearing forces, as would happen when food moves down the GI tract. Belt desmosomes anchor to actin filaments inside the cells. The bridges themselves are formed by proteins of the cadherin protein family. Spot desmosomes also connect cells together. They are small, disc-shaped adhesive plaques that are anchored to intermediate filaments, or cytokeratins, in the epithelial cells. They are strong intercellular binders and are commonly seen in tissue that needs strength, like the bladder. Under the microscope, they appear somewhat like buckles, buckling cells to one another. Just like belt desmosomes, these bridges are formed by proteins in the cadherin family, specifically desmoglein and desmocholin. A mnemonic device that may help you recall that the cadherin family of proteins are involved with desmosomes is to recall that in both the zonula adherens and macula adherens, the intercellular bridging proteins are cadherin proteins. Next, let's discuss the intercellular junction called hemidesmosomes. As we discussed earlier, the basement membrane of epithelium serves as a structural foundation for the epithelial tissue. But how is it attached to these cells? Well, the answer is the hemidesmosomes. Hemidesmosomes, or half-desmosomes, provide the attachment between the epithelial cells and the basement membrane. More specifically, they contain proteins called integrins, which extend from the base of the hemidesmosome into the lamina lucida, which, as you may recall, is the upper layer of the basal lamina, where they connect with a special type of glycoprotein called laminin. And now for a quick question to review your knowledge so far. What's the main functional difference between desmosomes and hemidesmosomes? Desmosomes function to connect or adhere epithelial cells together, whereas hemidesmosomes help connect epithelial cells to their basement membrane. Moving on to the next intercellular junction, let's discuss the gap junctions, which function to aid and regulate cell-to-cell communication. Gap junctions are well designed for cell communication. They have a unique hexagonal array, which consists of a complex of proteins called connexins. These connexins form a cylindrical connexon, which is basically a big tube that allows for direct transfer of small ions and molecules from one cell to another. Connexins can alter their conformation, opening and closing, to control exactly when cells can communicate with one another. Why would epithelial cells need to communicate? Well, they might need to act as a unit in response to injury, or as a unit to help with fetal development. Gap junctions are also found in cardiac muscle cells, where they allow the rapid transfer of ions between cells that is necessary for coordinating each heartbeat. And last but not least, let's discuss tight junctions. If you've been counting, it's the fifth type of intercellular junction. Tight junctions serve to regulate molecular movement between cells. Some types of epithelia, like renal tubular and GI epithelium, are important in molecular transport, where ions or small molecules are moved from one space to another by actually traveling through the epithelial cell itself. The polarity of the epithelial cells is key here, because a group of transport proteins on one side of the cell will absorb a molecule into the epithelial cell, and another group of proteins on the other side of the cell will then transport it out of the cell, thus moving the molecule across the epithelial barrier. This can happen for molecules ranging from small ions like sodium to larger proteins. But for this to work, we can't have all these molecules leaking passively and randomly between the epithelial cells. To prevent this leakage and regulate this movement, we have the tight junctions. Tight junctions, also called zonula occludens, are well named, since they tightly seal neighboring cells' plasma membranes to one another, preventing the passage of most large molecules through the intercellular space, that is, the space between epithelial cells. Tight junctions are not inflexibly impermeable to everything, though. Their permeability to smaller molecules and ions varies by tissue type, meaning some tight junctions are tighter than others. Also, interestingly, while tight junctions occlude the passage of most substances, they also may contain selective channels so specific substances may pass through. Besides regulating transport, tight junctions also help maintain epithelial cell polarity, preventing the specialized cell membrane proteins on the apical or basolateral membrane from sliding down and mixing with proteins from the other membrane. The tight junctions are made up of transmembrane proteins called claudins and occludins. These are anchored to the cell's actin cytoskeleton by zonula occludens proteins. Before we wrap up this section, let's try one last quiz question. What molecule do gap junctions use to connect cells with each other? Gap junctions connect cells together using connexins. Let's recap and see if we've completed our goals for this episode. First, can you recall the two major ways epithelium is organized? Epithelial tissue can be organized into layers or into glands. Next, can you describe the structural components of epithelial tissue? Epithelial cells rest on an underlying basement membrane, which has an outer layer called the basal lamina and an inner layer called the reticular lamina. Also, epithelial cells have polarity, meaning the proteins and functions of one side, for example, the apical cell membrane, may differ from the other three sides, the basolateral cell membranes. Lastly, keep in mind some lining epithelial cells have apical surface modifications that include microvilli, cilia, and stereocilia. Can you explain how covering or lining types of epithelium are classified? Well, first, epithelium is classified by the shape of the uppermost layer of cells, which can be squamous, cuboidal, or columnar. And second, epithelium is classified by the number of cell layers, which can be simple, or one layer, stratified, more than one layer, or pseudostratified, one layer, but falsely appearing to be stratified. Can you describe the unique and characteristic features of glandular epithelium? Glands are either exocrine or endocrine. Exocrine glands secrete onto epithelial surfaces through ducts, while endocrine glands secrete their products into the blood for circulation to target organs. Exocrine glands can be classified based on structure, unicellular versus multicellular, type of secreted product, serous or mucus, and the method of secretion, eccrine, holocrine, or apocrine. And lastly, can you list the five types of epithelial intercellular junctions and describe their basic function? The types of intercellular junctions are belt desmosomes, spot desmosomes, hemidesmosomes, gap junctions, and tight junctions. These connect epithelial cells to each other and to the basement membrane, and they also facilitate intercellular communication and regulate passage of substances between the cells. Armed with your newfound knowledge of epithelial cell histology, let's revisit our patient's story from the beginning of this episode. You may recall Mr. Stevens is presenting with a cyst on his back that has been recurring and growing despite multiple attempts at drainage. As you examine Mr. Stevens, you wonder, what could be the cause of this finding and why does it keep coming back? What are the management strategies for Mr. Stevens? You suspect that his cyst is caused by collection of sebum, skin oil, and cells, the products of a sebaceous gland. Draining the cyst may only help temporarily, since the sebaceous gland itself may remain intact. Because a sebaceous gland is a multicellular structure, draining the contents would just leave an empty cavity. Since sebaceous glands function through a holocrine secretion process, secretions may reaccumulate over time. Therefore, you decide to excise the glandular structure in total, including the epithelial lining. By removing the entire gland, you reassure him that you've done all that is possible to avoid recurrence. You happen to see him a few years later for another concern, and he gives you a thumbs up and thanks you for getting to the bottom of it. And that's all I have for histology of epithelial tissue. Thanks for joining me. If you like this episode, give it a thumbs up or a comment. You can enjoy the full BRIC experience online at www.usmle-rx.com, complete with illustrations, questions, flashcards, and active learning. Stay healthy out there.